Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is TWiG, This Week in Google, Episode 8 for September 19th, 2009. Freckley States. This Week in Google is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Gold account and get your free book at audiblepodcasts.com/twig. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter, user ID audible_com. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it. It's time for This Week in Google, the show that covers all things Google and cloud-worthy. It's so good to have the crew back. Gina Trapani is back from her move. I trust yes. All went well.
It did go well. And in honor of Talk Like a Pirate Day, I have to say, ahoy, mateys.
No, come on. Give us a good R.
Oh. Actually, Leo, I was hoping your pirate voice was.
Arr, me matey. There she is, the winch Gina Trapani. And I'm glad to see she hasn't left her bicycle behind.
No, it is behind me on purpose in the new place.
It's not on the wall, but it's still there.
It's like not watching on the wall yet.
And I'm so glad to see Jeff Jarvis back from surgery. Hey, Jeff.
Hey there.
How you feeling?
All right. I'm doing all right. If I collapse, don't mind me, but I'm doing fine.
Oh, I'm so glad. You know, I was following your tweets to make sure everything was okay. And your son, Jake, I think, tweeted first saying you went through surgery with flying colors on Monday. And I was so happy to hear that.
Yeah, all right.
So glad to have you back. And we have a new person on the show today from eWeek magazine. He does the Google Watch column at googlewatch.eweek.com. Clint Bolton, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Leo.
Clint's in beautiful Trumbull, Connecticut.
Right.
Yes. Are the leaves turning in Trumbull? I think they would be. Right.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We're getting red, green, gold, everything.
I'm jealous.
Beautiful.
Well, I'm glad you're here because Gina, Jeff, and I have no idea what any of this stuff means. Actually, Jeff probably does because he's following it. But the Department of Justice has now weighed in on the proposed Google Books search settlement. And Gina and I, before the show, were both confessing that this is all way too complicated.
It's too complicated.
I don't understand.
Please so make sense of this.
Could you, Clint, it'd be really useful for us if you'd at least set us up. Going back as far back as you want, what is going on with Google Book Search? What's the issue?
Well, the thing with Google Book Search is obviously it's an effort for Google to catalog the world's books online. They want to take millions of works, especially orphan books that are out of print and whose authors can't be found, to get permission and to get clearance about this. So it's a big deal because a lot of people are up in arms. They're concerned with antitrust issues. There's concern with privacy issues. And, a lot of the competitors that Google has, Amazon, Microsoft, Yahoo, they're concerned that Google is going to, extend their purview over the internet even more with searches and whatnot if this Google Book deal does go through. Privacy issues are a big deal because it involves Google, cataloging a lot of the users' content. When a user goes and does a book search, obviously it gets tracked through the IP address. Google says it's not saving that information, but the privacy folks, such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation, want to make sure that there are safeguards in place so that users' privacy rights are protected.
Seems like everybody has an opinion on this. There was the lawsuit happened. And it was a class action lawsuit from the publishers and the book authors. Right. And that was settled last year. Google agreed to set up, there was $125 million to set up some sort of publishing thing.
Right. A Google book, the book rights registry.
Rights registry. Okay.
Right. And this was October 2008 that this deal was signed.
Now, a judge is going to make a decision almost exactly a year later. I think it's October 10th.
October 7th.
Okay. He'll be ruling on whether this settlement can go forward or whether there'll be changes to it. And everybody's filed briefs from Amazon and Microsoft. Gary Reback's been hired, the attorney who got the DOJ, you know, sicked on Microsoft 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. He's been hired by Amazon, Microsoft, and some other parties, including, I think, was the EFF part of this group, to kind of, I guess, derail the settlement. The biggest news this week was that the Department of Justice on Friday filed its own brief, in which the kind of the bottom line was keep going, keep talking, but this settlement isn't sufficient and doesn't it sounded like the DOJ said this is really a matter for Congress, not for a civil settlement that will effectively change copyright law.
But Leo, too, the coverage of that DOJ thing was amazing because it was kind of anti-Google, and everyone said that the DOJ rejected the settlement. DOJ, in fact, said, and for their own press release, I'll quote here, that a properly structured set agreement in this case offers the potential for important societal benefits. The United States does not want the opportunity or momentum to be lost. So they're saying that they want, quote unquote, improvements in the settlement. They still want something to happen. I think we have to pull back here and say, what's the good to society? And the good to society is to have books digitized, the thoughts in them carried on, and able to reach new people.
Well, especially these orphan works. These are books that are out of print. They're not out of copyright because copyright is now infinite, apparently, according to Mickey Mouse. And so,
as old as Mickey Mouse,
as old as Mickey Mouse, and as long as Mickey Mouse continues to age, so will the copyright law. And so as a result, a lot of these books are going to be lost. They're not public domain. All the public domain stuff, there's no question there. But nor are they.
And all the things that have authors and publishers associated with them, they have
that's
the right
easy
to determine what's what.
Yeah.
And in fact, some of the things people don't like aren't from Google. They're from the authors putting, you know, DRM like requirements on their own work, which is, you know, that's the world we're in.
I'm kind of with you, Jeff. I think there's a huge public boon to having this stuff online, but I also fully understand the issues because Google isn't just scanning it and saying, here, we're going to make it available to everybody. There's a lot of restrictions on what they're doing with this material.
Right.
Right. There's issues in terms of what libraries will be charged. There's issues in terms of the revenue split that Google will now be able to sell these orphan books online.
Become a publisher themselves. They may say, oh, we got all the orphan works. And I think it was in the language. We're the only ones that can.
That's the issue that's going to get surely opened up here. And that's part of the process.
Yeah. I think this is a good process. Gina, I'm sorry. Did you were saying something?
No, I mean, I was, my dumb question is like, how is this different than the way that Google indexes the web?
Right. That's a good question to be asking. I don't think it is very different. But the fact is that there's, you know, when you're talking about, you know, rights holders, and then when you're talking about the monopoly issue, you know, Amazon has a big concern about this because they're obviously scanning their own books online and offering them via the Kindle e-reader. So they don't want this to happen at all because they feel that they're going to get cut out of a big slice of the pie, the book scanning pie.
Oh, yeah. Already, you know? Sony with their new e-book readers saying we have more books than Amazon. Because we've got the Google stuff on it.
Right. 1 million books.
Right.
1 million books.
All from Google.
Yep. Google opened up to those other readers. And that's part of what they've been doing in terms of trying to get the PR going here. Gina, I think I think Siva Vodnathian will have on later.
We're going to have Siva on for sure to talk about this in great detail.
University of Virginia.
Yeah.
But and he knows, but he's the author of a book called The Googleization of Everything. And he and I clash on this, but in a friendly way. But I think the essence the answer to your question is this. In the rest of the web, Google is not the host of the content. In the case of these books, Google is scanning the content and becomes the host of it and thus gains some measure of potential control over it that concerns people and for which there need to be protections. Everywhere else, Google is they're putting it on their servers so that they can index it, but they are not the host of the content.
I heard, it's okay, interesting because I heard, but to your point, Gina, some have said, in fact, a number of legal experts have said that they were puzzled that Google settled. They would have liked to see Google assert a fair use defense because, in fact, it is very much, they're not, when they scan the book, they index it. I mean, there is this whole issue of what do they do with the scan, they index, I mean, they store, they index my webpage and your webpage, they store a copy of it, Gina, on their server. It's not the only copy. It's not the canonical copy, but they do store a copy. And what the book search originally was, is you search for information and you would get a snippet. You wouldn't get the whole book, right, Jeff?
Yeah, and it's just like I can do on Amazon today. And for the books that are in Amazon's database, I can do that today, and it's useful, but I can't get to it from the web. And so the ideas are kind of trapped behind Amazon's wall, and Google, as is Google's want, wants to open up at least the information. But when you find that snippet, that information, you then can have the opportunity to buy the book online and read it, and Google will sell it to you if the author and publisher have agreed, and if they can find said author and publisher. So it is a different structure, but you're absolutely right. There's a fair use issue here we have to be careful of, because if Google and Daylife, where I work, and Bing cannot hold on to a copy of content so they can be smarter about it, then there goes search.
Wow. But Jeff, I mean, well, let me ask Clint this, actually. Do you have a sense of why Google didn't assert a fair use defense? Why Google went right to the settlement?
I think they thought that paying the $125 was the way, the quickest way to solve something that could have lasted, a suit that could have lasted for years and years. And I don't think Google, for competitive reasons, wanted to wait on this. I think they want to do this as quickly and as cleanly as possible, which is why I think they made that that payment, or tried to make that payment in October 2008. And I think that's, you know, they want things to go as smoothly as possible. Because again, you know, this is about competition here for Google, and the faster that they can do this. Look, they indexed the web faster than anybody, right? And they cultivated over 11 years a search dominance by being the first to everything after a while. And that's really what they want to do with Google Book Search. They want to get in there first, and they want to index as many titles as they can online. It's going to increase search traffic, and, you know, it's going to increase advertising revenue, because everybody's going to get a cut.
Well, at the time they made the settlement, I think Microsoft was still doing this. So there was some competition from Microsoft, but Microsoft's pulled out of their book scanning initiative.
Right. Microsoft pulled out in May 2008.
So, and it's Google and nobody. In fact, some people said, well, if Google doesn't do this, who's going to do this? Is there anybody? Right. What is this?
That's exactly the issue. No one's doing it. The publishers have had digital copies for years. They haven't done anything about this. They could have set up this structure. I was wondering whether there was a cloud way to do this. Is there a way that you could have a Gutenberg project-like way with these orphan books where we, the people, put it into the cloud somehow, but somebody has to do the work, which is very expensive, and store it, which is also expensive, and Google's the one that stepped forward. I think the main issue is that as long as others aren't prevented from doing this, that's the real issue. Is anyone else willing to invest in this?
There's also the issue of bad metadata. Jeffrey Nunberg, who's a linguist has a library blog, says if you've looked at the metadata, it's god awful. He said half the books are from 1899, even though none of them are from 1899. And he says it's not useful for researchers. So some of the benefit to the public of this is it may not materialize. Now, I think Google probably feels like, well, this is something that the we can crowdsource, that the internet can solve.
I wish they'd open it up. That's exactly
open
the way
it up.
The reflex. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's some other great things like footnote.org, I think it's called, that enables people to go into all kinds of databases and annotate them and link them and add stuff together, add data to them. There's also the Smithsonian, I think it is, or the Library of Congress photos that are up on Flickr. It's exactly what we ought to do, is have this as an open project of all the people.
Yeah, I think that's what I hope from, and who knows what the judge is going to do. But that's what I would hope from all of this is, yeah, Google, there should be some oversight. It needs to be opened up. I think I would hope that Google wants to do this and make it more open and assert maybe not. They're not going to monetize this by selling the books. They're going to monetize it as they monetize everything else. It's more eyeballs, right? Do they need to sell these books? Could they not make these somehow more open and available to others? I think that would solve a lot of concerns.
Well, but that was the offer back, was to say that we're not going to open this up so that you lose value. We will help.
That was their response. I see.
Right.
Now, what about the privacy concerns? Because that's a lot of scholars are very worried that Google will, as you said, monitor who's reading what. You go to a library, libraries are very careful and try very hard, despite the Patriot Act, to protect users' privacy. Google has none of those restrictions. Do you think that's an issue, Jeff?
privacy is always a concern and it's always there. The problem is, I think that it becomes the default response to everything today is to raise privacy flags and worry about that, and then to lose sight of the benefit of publicness and of having these things in public. It's terms of use. It's the time that data is held and is subpoenable, can be subpoenaed. Those are the issues, the same with our web habits. No difference, really.
I made this point to the NPR.
Just like the web.
That's what I said to the NPR producer, is your internet service provider knows everything about you, knows a lot more than Google knows about you. I don't hear everybody worried about that. Go ahead, Gina. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's, I was just going to say, I mean, Google knows all the web pages that you find. So if they know all the books that you look at, I mean, it's the same exact issue.
Yeah.
You know, as web search. And going back to what you're saying earlier about crowdsourcing this and opening it up. I mean, the reCAPTCHA acquisition is a very tiny step toward that, right?
Let's talk about that, because reCAPTCHA, I thought, was owned by Carnegie Mellon. I thought this was kind of an open project, but Google just bought it. So tell us about why reCAPTCHA helps Google Book.
Well, the way that reCAPTCHA works is that there's two words. It's basically the, you know, prove your human little form, right? But there are two words, one that the web page knows what it should be, and the other that it's not sure what it should be, but you don't know which one it knows. So you type in both words, and if you're correct on the first one, it assumes reCAPTCHA that you're correct on the second one. Now, the second image is a scanned piece of text the OCR software wasn't able to determine was correct.
Right.
So in a sense, you're helping them, you know, recognize text on books. So now if Google Books or Google hasn't done this already, I'm surely they will. The bits of text from those old books that the OCR didn't work for, they're going to chop them up and send them out via reCAPTCHA, which is across, you know, so many sites at this point, and humans will be helping.
You know, it's funny, though, that Google, as far as I could tell, Google didn't use reCAPTCHA. I just signed up for a bunch of Gmail accounts so we could have Google Voice accounts for all the shows. And it never used reCAPTCHA. It used its own capture, which wasn't as good as reCAPTCHA. So I hope they start using reCAPTCHA across Google. That would be nice. So,
I mean, it would be bizarre if they did.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's good news. Now, the other news story that was a big news story this week, and we will be talking a lot more about book search over the next month as we get closer and closer to this judicial decision. And I don't think that the judge is going to decide everything. Clint, that's my sense, is that the judge is October 7th. The judge is going to have a hearing, but he's not going to decide anything at that time. Or is he?
I'm not clear exactly, tell you the truth.
He could.
It's a fairness. He could, but there's a good chance this is going to be drawn out. I expect Judge Denny Chin in the Southern District of New York to really take a hard look at this, and especially paying attention to what the Department of Justice has said, looking at the antitrust concerns, the concerns about monopolization of Google Book Search, the privacy concerns. You know, the class action concerns, they're not, the DOJ is not happy with the way Google Book Search deals with the federal rights procedure, Rule 23. So this is something that is going to get dragged out. And I expect Denny Chin to ask Google to make a lot of the changes that the Department of Justice has suggested.
Yeah. I
expect this to drag on.
I thought the DOJ brief was really pretty good. I mean, it really addressed all the issues.
I agree.
It also said that some of this stuff really shouldn't be decided by anybody but Congress. This is not the place to decide some of these copyright issues.
Right.
So maybe some of those things will be thrown out. Anyway, as I started to say, we're going to be talking a lot more about this. And when Siva comes on, I think we might even spend a whole show talking about the Google Book Search. Because, I agree with you, Jeff, this has potential, huge potential. We want these books scanned in. We just have to do it in a fair and correct way.
And Siva understands where all those issues lie. I don't think he'd disagree about the benefits here, but he understands well, can say it far better than I can, where the perceived dangers are.
So besides buying reCAPTCHA, there was a rumor created by one single tweet, I might add, that Google might buy Brightcove. Is there any news on that? Or was that just that one tweet and then it just disappeared?
It seemed like something
more except retweets.
Yeah, Clint. What?
Clint, have you seen?
Everybody retweeted it. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Everybody retweeted
that makes it true.
And then, I think somebody went out and sort of disproved it, or at least said that that there was nothing going on along those lines.
Okay. It was Mark Glazier of PBS's Media Shift who tweeted it, and I guess that's some credibility.
Right. Right. Well, everybody wants to now, you know, with the acquisitions of, Google trying to acquire Onto Technologies and then reCAPTCHA, everybody sort of, wants to take a look at, what Google's going to buy next. It's very fashionable to sort of figure out what direction they're going in next.
Yeah, what and are if they you get up a to?
Yeah, if you get a company like Brightco on top of YouTube, you can make a case for Google, owning video on the web.
Right. Somebody commented that they wish we had talked more about Android last week. I'm going to let Gina's the resident Android expert. There were a couple of Android phones announced, and very interestingly, a tablet from Arcos, the Arcos 9, built on the Android platform. Did you look at any of these, Gina, with interest?
Yay.
I know.
Yeah. I didn't. I haven't seen them yet. I'm excited about the October 11th release. I think is it the Hero that's coming the 11th?
The Hero, yeah. HTC Hero, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I didn't get a chance to check out the new ones that came out, but I'm very excited.
There's a
about
Motorola Click, which is the UI is completely redesigned. It's Android under the hood, but it floats by tweets and Facebook postings like the screensavers floating around with all your social cloud of stuff going around, which is kind of wild.
I can see that being irritating or groundbreaking. Yeah. But it goes back to Marissa Meyer said, as I've quoted a few times here, that we're talking about the hyper-personal news stream.
Right.
Dave Weiner talks about the river of news. I think that this idea that once you're ubiquitously constantly connected, then the idea that something rings for you is a bit odd. <It's>
Yeah.
Right.
Who needs a ring?
Right. Click does seem like a very socially, socially oriented phone, a social networking phone that I think that it is well timed for a Christmas season, for the holiday season, the buying season. This is something that could really take off with, teens and 20 somethings who are, using social networks to communicate. It could be a big deal. It could be a big deal for Motorola, who really needs a big win here.
The Hero does some of the same things. It's not as, I think that the Click is for people Jake's age, people under 25, and the Hero is more for people Gina's age. And I've got a razor for you and me, Jeff. I think that Motorola razor is going somewhere. a phone. That's just a phone. The Hero is going to, apparently with a UI, going to surface Flickr pictures and things like that. So this seems to be a trend in Android devices. That's maybe one complaint people have about Android is that its UI is kind of stuffy, but you're not tied to the UI at all, it sounds like. You can do anything you want with it.
Yeah, yeah, you aren't tied to it. In fact, later on, I'll talk about it in my tip. I kind of, my love for Android was renewed this week because I flashed I installed a custom ROM, which was very exciting. Ooh. I'll talk about that a little later.
Not this isn't Donut. This is firmware or a different.
Yeah,
developer.
It's a custom build of Android that actually pulls in some of Donut's features. Which is pretty cool because you get them on the G1. So
save it. Save it for
later.
I should mention.
But, it's funny.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Nope,
no, I was going to say you start to say about different generations. On the web, I would love to talk about the Mint acquisition and some of the reaction about that.
Yeah, now Gina has always been very clear with me on this show that it's not just Google, it's cloud computing as well. And in fact, because of you, Gina, and your blog post saying it's safe to use Mint, I installed Mint, and actually because of that and the iPhone application, fell in love with it, put every account in there, and then Quick and Intuit bought it. Bummer, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first, let me say that at some point I said, I'm just going to stop being paranoid and give in and try out Mint. I mean, I know it's safe as far as, its privacy policy in terms of use, that kind of thing. And I love Mint.
Oh, I do too.
It's a great
it's
app.
Fantastic.
And I went because I didn't want to use Quicken anymore. So, you hear about the Intuit acquisition. It's just like, I mean, Intuit had Quicken Online, which wasn't terrible. And there was an iPhone app, which, wasn't so bad, but Mint was better. But I thought the reaction was interesting. 37 Signals, Jason Fried posted a post about how, Mint gave in to the old generation. The old generation is sucking up the new generation of the web. And I thought that was such an interesting reaction because actually, I think it was Derek Pauzek who said, you know, the web, there are no generations.
Right.
You know, we're all, the web is just a stream and we're all in it together. You know, no, there's no generational.
And you know, if somebody offers me $170 million, I don't know if I'm going to be so worried about generations.
What are you going to do, Leo? Come home and say, honey, I turned down $170 million and I'm such a good guy?
They were the wrong generation. I just couldn't go with it, you know, man.
Right.
That was the old school. You know?
Well, let me ask.
There was argument about VCs forcing this, but Fred Wilson on his blog, abc.com, who's obviously a VC, said, you know, it doesn't really happen much that way. That if the founders want to sell, you're pretty foolish to force them not to, because they're going to be pissed.
Right.
And he's been through that a few times, I think, with Delicious and places like that, where somebody comes home and they say, well, here's a life-changing amount of money. I'm taking it.
I think that was such a huge amount of money. I can't see how anybody could turn it down. Except maybe my friend.
Well, you know, how is this any different than, you know, a larger entrenched company buying a startup? You know, I mean, what is the difference here? This has been going on since time out of mind.
Yeah.
Nobody complains when IBM goes and buys a startup, you know, or when Microsoft goes and buys a startup. You did hear some outcry when Google went to acquire Onto Technologies, but those are, you know, for different reasons. So I don't know. I don't understand the what everybody's getting upset with, although I should clarify that I'm not an Intuit or a Mint user. So
yeah.
You're right, Clint. It's interesting, too, that if you think back to other companies that have screwed up startups they bought, the worst, I think, was AOL.
Ugh.
Everything it bought died or turned to crap. Yahoo is half and half. It really depends on what happens to the company.
Right.
Although, I should point out, stealthily and sneakily, AOL has snuck back in, and now they have a dozen very profitable properties, and all of a sudden, AOL is the king of the blogs. You know, I mean, getting Weblogs Inc. and a few other things together, AOL kind of reinvented itself. So I don't know if you can say AOL, you know, certainly the Time Warner thing was a bad idea.
Right.
Who's done better? You know, Google's done badly with a lot of its acquisitions. In fact, we were trying to get Uri Engstrom on, and we're going to still try to get him on of Jaiku fame, and one of the companies Google bought and didn't really seem to do anything with.
Right.
Yahoo, of course, famous, although, again, they have a ton of properties that are incredibly successful and valuable. AOL.
Skype and eBay.
Well, there's a bad one. In fact, the latest news on Skype is who knows what's going to happen now? Lawsuits are flying.
Yeah, it's absolutely all tied up in legal. It's a huge amount of legal imbroglios here. And it's not clear how that's going to shake out, but it seems as though the direction that it's heading in is that eBay shareholders could take a big hit from this, depending how the lawsuit shakes out.
I don't care.
Because
I don't care if they take a hit as long as Skype doesn't go away.
Right. Well, that would be disastrous. But I don't see how that could happen. I really don't expect. I mean, there's almost 500 million users of Skype.
Yeah.
And that would absolutely be disastrous.
Talk about too big to fail.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was talking about this on the radio show. You know, Johnson sent in the troops to keep the steel factories running. I wonder if Obama would send in, I don't know what he'd send in, the IT guys to keep Skype running. I mean, talk about too big to fail. We can't lose Skype. This whole show, my whole network's running on Skype.
Right. But there's really nothing you can do about it until this copyright infringement suit is settled. You know, they own the IP. They own the core source code technology. And there's nothing that can be done about that unless that's settled. So this is going to be tied up. I expect a cash settlement of some sort, a big one going to the Skype guys or the former Skype guys, I should say. Now the Jolted guys, you know, so I expect them to get a big cash settlement and possibly for them to try, if they could, make another run at Skype, you know, because this is not a done deal. Skype, eBay selling 65% of Skype to Silver Lake and other investors, Andreessen Horowitz. This is far from a done deal, especially with these lawsuits. So there's a lot of different ways this can go.
I was trying to figure that out, Clint. So is that one of the scenarios? Is that put them in a position where I couldn't figure out how this happens? How does it put the founders in a position to be able to take the company back over because of the suit? Is it, you know, a noose around everybody else? How would that work?
Well, they own the IP.
I believe so. They own the IP.
They have the golden snitch. And
they can buy it for a lower price than is out there now, because otherwise they're going to get paid the rest.
Well, whoever's got whatever else they have, all they have is a name and a ball of useless technology.
Right.
So it's just like Quidditch, you know, you can play and be leading in points for 3 hours and somebody gets a snitch, it's all over.
That was very geeky.
Without that IP, Skype doesn't really it doesn't have the value to the investors that are putting money into it. You know, the $2 million or whatever it is, that, or $2 billion that they're investing into it. Right. So without that intellectual property, you know, it's going to be a huge problem.
What do you got? You got nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The paywall got a little higher. This is one for Jeff Jarvis. Got a little higher this week when Wall Street Journal said, oh, by the way, those of you who use our iPhone application, we may from time to time charge you to read. This is what Rupert Murdoch said would happen. The Journal is the only publication ever to that I know of that succeeded with a paywall.
The Journal and the Financial Times.
FT,
and the reason
right.
is the same. Yeah, it was, frankly, I thought it was always odd that the Journal's iPhone app was free. It was a back door I think somebody forgot about along the way, and now Rupert said, would you close that kid?
Well, there's one more back door, and I'd be really mad if they close this. If you find a Wall Street Journal article with Google News, for reasons I'll never understand, you can click through to that journal article and read it in full. If you try to go it otherwise, it'll say, well, you're not a subscriber. You can only read a summary.
Because there are people there who understand the value of marketing and links. You know, we've got to figure that out in this. I saw that the BBC, I'm going to forget the number, puts out a few 10 million clicks a month to other news sources. And I have to look that up in a minute. And I'll find that. Whereas, as I mentioned on the show before, Google News sends out 1 billion clicks a month.
Wow.
So you'd have to be pretty much a fool to pass that up to your competitors, because your competitors' stories are right there.
That's interesting. So you don't think it's a case of oversight as it was with the iPhone. You think this is an intentional hole, but it's a pretty big hole. I mean, frankly, I don't need to be a Wall Street Journal online subscriber because I can just use Google.
Plus, if you come to an individual story, that's not the value of the Wall Street Journal. The value of the Wall Street Journal is you being a subscriber.
Right. Right.
And maybe you'll become a subscriber. It's the best way to sell, you know, online, your content is your ad. And so it's the best way to sell your
own. So they're hoping maybe after a few times going to Google News to get the story, I'll just buy it and use it on.
And don't forget, their traffic is low, and so this causes more traffic and causes more ad inventory on that traffic.
Their traffic is low because of the paywall, you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
So they need, that's part of the reason they bought MarketWatch back in the day, is they needed open free traffic to get more ad inventory.
That's the problem with the paywall. It's kind of this catch 22.
Right.
And if you don't get people to pay, then you're really screwed.
Right. You charge $100 a year for a subscription, which no one else is doing. But if people, there's many, many other sources, obviously, as everyone here knows, to go and get news, some 20-something thousand news sources indexed by Google, you know, why are people going to go to the Wall Street Journal? What is the impetus? What reason would they have to go there for $100 and, you know, a year? That's a lot of money when everybody's used to getting stuff for free on the web.
So I
just read a great essay from Paul Graham of Y Combinator I got on the air here.
Oh, man.
Wonderful essays arguing that we've never bought content and publishers have never sold it. That if we did buy it, then better content would cost more. Instead, it's the form that dictates.
Oh, that's price interesting.
Structure. They said that selling information is different. That's why, in fact, Wall Street Journal does do well. That's why. Unpaid, because people make money on it. That's why the Bloomberg terminal is worth a lot of money, because you're buying information in that case. We don't really buy content. And the only way to sell it in the future, he argues, is either by getting it through the side door, which is advertising, or by attaching it to a device.
Because that's the form.
Yep.
Then you're buying the form.
Yeah.
Well, that's brilliant. I just think he's amazing. That's an interesting take. Is it the take of Chris Anderson and Free? Is it the same basic thought?
I think so.
Yeah.
Graham goes through, I blogged about it quickly, and I said, I've got to think about it a little more, but I think it's up there with Clay Shirky's amazing essay called Thinking the Unthinkable about newspapers and why pay won't work.
Right.
And so he's looking at it in that very abstract, wonderful way, but then goes into every possible kind of content and says why charging won't work. And why this is where we are and how we have to look at it. Then he also says, he apologizes at the end for saying, I'm sorry I'm writing about this in the context of old forms. But that's because I don't know what the new forms are.
Paul is just always blows my mind. I like to read his stuff because it just opens up all sorts of thoughts. I want to take a break, talk a little bit about audible.com. We have a phone number now that people can call us. We actually have a Google voice line. And if you want to call with feedback or questions or suggestions, 9795-TWIG-VM. That's the easy to remember. Sort of easy to remember. 9795-TWIG-VM or just +1 979-589-4486. Leave a message. Remember that when you leave a message, you're giving us permission to use it on the show, and try to keep it under a minute. I'm not likely to use it if it gets too much longer because Jeff has pizza night. But and we can't go on and on and on. But we have like 80 calls, and I'll get to a few of them in just a little bit. But before I do that, I want to thank our sponsor today, of course, Audible.com, publishers of Jeff's great book and audio, but many other books.
Leo, I got in trouble last time.
Did you?
Too many plugs for the book, What Would Google Do? And so I promised that I wouldn't plug the book, What Would Google Do this time? Because Audible wouldn't let us. And I was just trying to joke about the fact that they wouldn't let me plug.
What would Google do?
Well, I'm not going to do it anymore. Not this week.
You know, if Google had an audiobook on audible.com, I think they would plug it. So that's what Google would do. So it makes perfect sense.
You said that. I didn't.
It makes perfect sense. Audible.com is a great place to go. If you like podcasts, you know, this is just one more wonderful source of great literature. Audiblepodcast.com/twig. Now, this actually, I don't know if this confirms Paul's theory or not. I think it does, because they're not selling the device, but they're selling the form of audiobooks. And believe me, I mean, you know, you can listen to an audiobook, have your Kindle read it to you. That ain't the same as having somebody who really, you know, knows how to bring a book to life read to you. And that's what they do. They are so good about making these books jump to life, whether it's Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, which is the newest Jane Austen novel, or Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol. I can't, frankly, read Dan Brown in paper with a straight face, but they make wonderful audiobooks because basically it's like you're listening to the movie. I just see Tom Hanks running around. Audiblepodcast.com/twig. If you go there right now, you can sign up for a gold account that gives you a book a month, and your first one's free. In fact, even if you cancel, you get to keep that one for the rest of your life. So pick wisely in business and classics, history, nonfiction and fiction, kids and young adults even, mysteries and thrillers, romance, science and technology, sci-fi, self-development, and more. They even have comedy performances, old-time radio shows. It's just a feast of audio listening entertainment. I don't know what I'm going to recommend today. There's so many great books out there. The Big Download, of course, of The Lost Symbol. I've been reading a lot of rave reviews. In fact, I guess I'll recommend, since we were talking about performance, I haven't read this book, but I'm told this is an amazing performance. It's called The Help by Catherine Stockett. It is the highest rated book ever on audible.com. 4.89 out of 5 based on 1,831 ratings. And I think it's because of the performance. Cassandra Campbell, Jenna Lamia, Octavia Spencer, and Bonnie Turpin. Apparently a brilliant performance of The Help by Catherine Stockett. Make that our pick of the week. But the point is, you get to choose. Audible.com, audiblepodcast.com/twig. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Google. audiblepodcast.com/TWIG. You might be tempted to use a different code. Use that code, because then we get credit. And we want Gina and Jeff to get the credit for a job well done. And whatever you do, don't listen to What Would Google Do. It's too good of a book. You'll have to buy it. And we wouldn't want that, would we, Jeff?
I didn't say a word there.
This is an example, though, I think, of what Paul was talking about, because it is, in a way, you're not buying the book. You're buying the performance. You're buying the form. You're buying the ability to put it on your portable device. And that kind of makes sense. You know, that's the value I'm getting out of that.
You know, I teach a course in entrepreneurial journalism, and I was out this last class for obvious reasons. My substitute friend told me that a couple of the students were thinking about doing books. And I said, well, that's not really a business. Well, no, if they rethink it in terms of an ongoing business and it's just part of the process.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll consider that.
It is a business in a way. Yeah. Could be. That's actually the challenge. And actually, I think that's kind of fun because in order to understand this, you have to rethink. It's kind of a good exercise to rethink every business in this new form. And what is an appropriate form going forward for any business, whether it's the record industry, the book industry, and there probably is an appropriate form for everything, I would imagine. So do you want to hear some of our feedback from our many, many callers? Or should actually, why don't we do, I'm trying to decide what order to do this. Why don't we do our tip and pick and everything? And that way, if Jeff needs to run, he can. How about that? So, because it is pizza night.
Cool.
Is every Saturday pizza night, Jeff?
Metaphorically.
Let's start with Gina Trapani. We missed you last week. Her tip of the week, everybody.
Cool. Yay. Okay. My tip of the week is for adventurous Android users. And I got to tell you, I don't think there is any other kind. If you're using Android,
yes,
you're probably pretty
you're a leader.
Adventurous.
Yeah.
But yeah, an early adopter. So I moved into a new place this week and it's a new building and the wiring was bad and I did not have internet access at home, which just killed me. Just totally killed me. I'm serious. I'm still recovering. But so I finally took the leap and I got root access to my Android phone, which let me tether. And so in order to get basically getting root access to your Android phone lets you install a custom build of Android. And there are lots of custom builds of Androids out there. Some of them include some of the donut features. Most of them include give you root access to the device, which opens up a little extra functionality. And in order to do it, there's an application called Recovery Flasher, which you can download from the web because, you know, there's no pesky iTunes store approval process to deal with. Of course, I had to say that. And you download that to your phone just through the phone's web browser, and it lets you boot the phone up and then install a custom Android build. So it's a few steps and it takes a little time and you lose some of your settings, but I have it all written up at smartaware.org, which we'll link in the show notes. So I use the Cyanogen mod. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Cyanogen mod. And I just fell in love with Android all over again. My G1 is so much faster. I have a better keyboard and I also can now tether. It's a one click tether, so I can get online anywhere.
So in every other respect, it looks the same. You just can do more stuff.
It looks very similar. It depends on what custom build of Android you install. I was kind of conservative and went with a stable build of Cyanogen mod, and it looks very similar. But it gives you that tethering. I downloaded that tethering app, and it gives you a terminal and some other good looking stuff. There's a keyboard. The keyboard is a little better, which I believe is coming in Donut. But there are other builds that will give you applications that are coming out on different Android devices. That
so
not all Android devices get. So there's a database of Android builds, and you can choose which build you want.
Who's this guy talking on your video? Is that you?
I'm simply doing God to it.
This is the guy that helped me. No. This is the guy who did it. Did a video describing how to do the flashing process, which really helped me out. I read a bunch of tutorials, and that guy's video was the thing that got me.
Isn't it funny now we're starting to do, you know, I always thought, oh, it'd be so much easier in text. And sometimes now it is. It's a lot easier just to watch a video.
It's true. That video is really short and easy.
Smarterware.org, a great place to go for lots of tips. Gina's just cranking them out these days. I tell you. But also...
Well, not as fast as when I had internet.
Well, and you know, we should say Gina's on wireless today. And I think that's where the coming and going is. There's a little bit of a dropout on you. So We'll get you wired next time. But your internet's okay? It's working?
Yeah, it's working. It's working now. Sorry about that.
Hallelujah. And now our number of the week. And that comes to us from the great Jeff Jarvis.
Well, in a dog ate my homework moment, my number was going to be 5, which is the whole
You know, I body. Almost said, is your number going to be 5? I almost said that.
But by the way, while we're on, I had robotic surgery for prostate this week. And that's why fascinating thing was, just a little geek moment, they put you out an hour before the surgery because people get freaked seeing the robot assembled above them.
Oh, I would.
That it was. I went into the room and it was like seeing a Sigourney Weaver enemy.
I didn't know it was robotic. So when you say robotic, it's not an autonomous robot. There's somebody
robot assisted. Yeah, surgery. So the surgeon is 5 feet away from you.
Oh, good.
In a monitor controlling the stuff. And there's five little arms inside you. I'll stop there.
And why do they do it that way? Because is it microsurgery or?
Yeah, it's arthroscopic.
I see. So they're using a camera and.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that's cool. So,
I did write about it on my blog. If you have the stomach for it, I've got the details.
Do you have pictures of the robot?
Yeah, a little picture of the robot. Yeah, they always try to show the robot on the website being really small. You know, I said on the website it's like the kind of robot that, you know, turns knobs on Cooper Minis or something. And you walk in the room and it's this really imposing, huge Sigourney Weaver thing. But the robot was my friend. So I was going to not have a number, but at the last minute, the number is 300 million, which is the number of users, of course, that Facebook has these days, which leads to a John Mattel post saying that, I love having a theme.
Sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
We gotta have a contest.
I was queuing up my tip, and it started playing. I hate it when pages start playing music. Go ahead.
Worse if somebody points it out.
Yeah. No, not at all. I'm glad you did. Otherwise, I would have had to.
But Mattel says that Facebook's automated ad system is getting preference from a lot of advertisers versus Google's because you're targeting on a social action rather than on content. You have that happening. You also have Google announcing this week that it's extending a DoubleClick into now a marketplace for display ads at quality sites. I asked Rashad Tabakawala, who's the head of strategy at Starcom, big ad agency, on Twitter right before the show, what this means. And he says he thinks it means there'll be a lot of new money in the marketplace as a result.
Hmm.
So it ain't over, and there's now all kinds of new battlefronts for ad dollars.
Very interesting. I like it. It's good for us as new media. We like to hear that. It's the more money that's floating around, the more I can grab out of the sky. My tool is actually a terrible, horrible thing, but if I don't do it, nobody, you know, everybody's going to yell at me, and it's this new Google Fast Flip, and I think it actually is something that we could talk about because it doesn't make any sense. It's like, why is Google doing this? Google Fast Flip, which is from Google Labs, if you go to Google Labs, you can get fastflip.googlelabs.com, is designed to make it more, reading your news, more like reading a paper? What? And if you you could do it by topic. It's not a replacement for Google Reader. You could check sources. You could check topics. It has trending topics. In fact, it's really what it apparently is, as far as I could tell, is a search engine where you'll enter in a search using the word section before it, and then you'll get a variety of pages that you then click down into. And it takes two clicks to get to the original source, but you can scroll through it. It is a very strange idea. And some say it's a MacGuffin, that it's Google's way of showing the newspapers it's all over.
Leo, I liken it to when you used to scroll through the microfiche in a library.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's like.
Just keep going, scroll. Do people read newspapers that way? I don't know. You know, if you're just casually reading a newspaper, you're not going to do that. You're doing research and you need to look through a lot of content, for a longer period of time. You might do that. You might do scans like that to search for certain articles. And it might be a very beneficial and efficient way to do that.
I guess you're right. If you're looking for pictures or you're looking for scanning for concepts, you're right. This might be a better way to do it, I guess.
You know, I think a lot of the media jumped on this and absolutely, you know, slammed Google and said a lot of the coverage that I had read from my peers and colleagues, they didn't like this at all. They said it was a lousy service. I disagree. I don't think it's a lousy service. I mean, it is what it is. It's another way to search Google. When the Wonder Wheel was announced and Google Squared were announced, people weren't bashing those tools. I think Google's taking a lot of heat over this. I don't think they proclaimed it as being the next coming of Google News, but don't get me wrong, I think they would love it. They would absolutely love it if people were to search Google News this way and to skip through stuff because they would see a whole lot more ads. You know, I did my first run through on this and I saw so many ads. I did 5 minutes of testing on this.
That's a good
point.
So
many ads. And, clicking on an article about Patrick Swayze last week from Us Magazine when he had passed away. And over on the right was an ad from the National Cancer Institute. Is that morbid or is that tacky or right. Is that ingenious? I don't know which. You know, I'll leave that up for you to decide. But it was certainly effective. It caught my eye. You know, when I'm you're reading
right.
about
every single
ways,
every single page know? For you go through, you get another ad
right
over on the right there. I didn't even notice yep. that.
So I did that search and I found the National Cancer Institute ad, you know, next to the article about Patrick Swayze. I circled back to that article a couple minutes later and there was another ad there for Whitney Houston's new album. So those huh. ads are changing and they are recycling. So that's it's pretty smart. But whether or not people use it on a regular basis, enough to make it a replacement for Google News, I don't know.
You know, Leo, it was Shane Richmond at the Telegraph in London, and I have this link up on the friend feed, did a great letter from fake Eric Schmidt, saying, you know, we got you suckers. Happy now, bitches, it says.
That's kind of my thinking.
I think it's you know, last week I accused Google of being cynical in offering checkout to these fools who want to charge for newspapers.
Right.
I tend to look at this in the same light. I think it's either a cynical way to say, okay, you want this? Fine, here it is. Or worse, it's a naive way to say, oh, okay, we listen to you fools who messed up the news industry.
Yeah, here's what you were asking for. Look.
And why give it to them? The other right. fear I have with this is I think that we're going down to a limited number of sources. The beauty of Google and even Google News and Daylife, where I'm a partner, is that they have thousands of sources, and that's the true path to serendipity to find the sources you want. In this, you are limited to a certain number of sources.
And all and very also, mainstream, very mainstream sources.
Right, yeah. And Google has had others. 39. Right now, I think that's where they're trying to, if they're trying to suck up to the newspaper industry and they're doing it sincerely, I see danger in that because Google knows better than the industry does. And if we end up with a very limited number of sources, there's a new aggregator out this week in Germany called Nachrichten.de that has only 500 sources from major sources. Google had its featured content a few weeks ago. Now it has this. That's limiting. We should be going the opposite way.
Right.
At the same time, by the way, note that Google now marks on Google News if content comes from a blog. They didn't really explain mm-hmm. why. Do you know, Clint?
No, just that it's part of Google's... Part of Google's, you know, longstanding effort to bulk up the search options, you know, just like they do offering Google searches for past 24 hours and offering more varieties and more ways for users to search. Why they're having the blog, you know, designation, I'm not quite sure. But, you know, it's again, these are things that are experimental. They may come and go. There's a lot of things in Google that they start, they roll out, and eventually they fade away. So we'll have to see what happens with that.
It does feel a little bit like it's deprecating it to say, well, just so you know, that's from a blog.
Do they do it from a New York Times blog too? Has anybody seen?
Doesn't look like they do. I'm trying
that's,
to
yeah, I haven't come
that's
across
a good question.
Yet.
Yeah. Well, I just searched for Mint, for instance, and the second entry is the Mint blog. It doesn't say blog on it, even though it's mint.com/blog. So I don't know who gets to be a blog. Let me search for Android hacking. That'll show up some blogs. See if I can.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not seeing the designation. Oh well. Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. Anyway, it's worth taking a look at Flip. For what it's worth, I think you make a good point, Clint, that there are some searches that it might be useful for. Did you say it's only 39 sources?
Yes, 39 sources. Sources like TechCrunch, New York Times, Washington Post.
Hey, TechCrunch, that's a blog. How dare
sure
they?
Sure is.
Yeah.
What are they putting a blog in there for? Man, the Daily Beast. I don't even know.
Dave Weiner and Jay Rosen and others complain about Twitter's selected users list.
Right.
And this is Google's equivalent, and I think that's dangerous. It sets up it maintains an old hierarchy. Rather than enabling a new one to emerge.
Yep. With you on that. And I don't, and I think Clint might be right that they haven't thought it out that much. This is just something they threw out there. It's just a lab.
But the thing is they launched it at TechCrunch 50 and a lot of people were paying attention to that. So it picked up a lot of buzz, right along with Bing Visual Search. Those were the two biggest announcements out of the show. So a lot of people picked up on that and got a lot of coverage. And when things get a lot of coverage, people tend to attach more import to the things that are being launched.
So
I think that's what you saw there.
I really do like the Bing visual search. I think that's kind of cool because it just looks so much like it's out of the Matrix.
Right. Well, that's Silverlight in action. That's the Silverlight plugin for you there. Erstwhile flash killer.
So I've got digital cameras, and then I can narrow it by the number of megapixels with a slider, and then it kind of rearranges itself, and then I could say, but I want a better optical zoom, and it's a demo, but it's a cool demo. It's a fun demo. Like it. All right. There's a freebie. that'll be your pick, Clint.
Okay.
Now, do you want to take off, Jeff, or do you have some time to listen to quite a few? I won't play
them
all.
Unless they're going to complain about me plugging my book.
No, not a one of them.
All right.
Not a one of them. You know, one of the nice things that Gina mentioned a couple of weeks ago is that Gmail now has a player in it for Google Voice messages, and this is what I'm going to use, and it works really nicely. It's a great way to kind of, when you have a big full mailbox, review them. So again, our Google voicemail number is 9795-TWIG-VM. Let's listen to some of the voicemails that we got from people, quite a few of them. And any comments you have, just let me know after we hear it.
Hi, Leo. My name is Daniel Horton. I'm in Huntsville, Alabama. Hey, listen, I'm loving This Week in Google. You guys are doing an awesome job. I have a question for you guys related to Google services for businesses and universities. I'm a web and graphic designer at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. And some of our administration has looked into getting Gmail and Google Docs and some of the other services from Google as a service for our faculty and students. However, the trick is some of us in tech positions at the university have had a hard time detailing why this is so beneficial for everyone as opposed to the kind of archaic stuff that we've been using for over 10 years now. Some of those who've had objections to Google services have cited that Google would have access to sensitive information within our university. As you know, sometimes we deal with research projects with government contracts and the like. Some others have also unfortunately cited the fact that Gmail was down for a little while a couple of weeks ago. So my question for you guys is, what would you point out to those people in the administration who are having these concerns? How can we address those concerns about privacy and uptime? Thanks again.
People who are switching to Google Docs, and I know a lot of universities are starting to use Google Mail. Gina, is there a response to that? Is it possible to be private and secure with Google Mail?
Well, you know, the privacy issue is a good question. I know, especially with like state universities, you know, email. Do you have me?
Yeah, you're coming and
can
going.
Can you hear me?
You're coming and going.
Oh, sorry about that.
That silly Wi-Fi. We'll bear with it. It's all right.
I was going to say the privacy question is a tough one, especially with like universities. Often email is a matter of public record, but there's also private information, sensitive information. And I think the best thing to do in terms of evaluating whether or not it's the right choice is to look at the Google apps for universities and corporations material and look at the privacy policy. I mean, the best way to convince people, if you want to convince people that Gmail is a good choice, is to tell them, you know, imagine having email without any space restrictions. You know, imagine never getting that message that says your mailbox is full ever
That's
again.
That's so nice. And, yeah.
And imagine being able to get to your email from your phone, from your home computer, from anywhere, and not have to worry about, you know, Outlook's web interface or VPNs or any.
Yeah, because it's HTTPS. It's secure HTTP.
I think that the evaluation process is definitely important.
Right. I love the in the transcription.
Right, exactly.
In the transcription, they transcribed administrators as Mr. Asians. The faculty and students was transcribed as Freckley States. And government contract came out as Army contract. So that was pretty good. They did a good
job. I see an audio capture coming soon. Leo, just one more point. In last week's list on Friend Feed, there was a link that I put in there about the 5 million students, was the number of the week last week, who are now using Google Apps. There's also a map there of universities. So I suggest that our caller, as we say in radio, can go and find a lot of the administrators there and find out their rationale. Also note that Google last week, I think for the Government 2.0 conference, released a view of Google Apps for government. And part of what they're going to offer there is higher security. People with clearance use it, only be in the U.S. and so on and so forth. So they are moving to more mission critical, even government things. And that link is also on the Friend Feed.
Yeah, these are things they're going to have to address anyway from everybody if they're going to make inroads into those areas that they want to be in, like government. like universities. Here's another caller from South Africa.
Hi, Leo. This is Andre from South Africa. Being in the traffic on the way back from a tech call, listening to your Twig podcast. Greetings from South Africa.
Just a hello from South Africa. And here's one from Australia.
Hi, Leo. It's Andrew Nevin here calling from Australia. I just want to leave a voice message on your Google Voice service. Sorry, Leo, you're talking as I speak. Just going to pause you. Just want to say I have been a big fan of your show for a number of years, and I am one of the 1% that pays not $2, but $5 a month for the show. It's
See, the paywall works!
Change for entertainment that you give me every day of the week.
It's not a Please wall, it's a party. Work.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's not a wall, is it?
I rely on you for my daily trip to the office. Thank you very much.
Very nice calls. Again, it's 97.95 Twig VM. Here's one for you, Gina.
Hello, Twig crew. I had a quick question about Google Voice. I wanted to know if Google Voice is treated as a mobile number or is it treated as a landline number? So, for instance, if I'm calling on my cell phone and my cell phone plan has free mobile-to-mobile calls, how is that treated by the carrier? Just wondering if you had an answer to that. Have a great day.
I think it's a landline, isn't it?
That's a good question, actually. When you make a phone call on Google Voice, it calls a Google internal number, and I think that it is a landline. I believe that is a landline, but I could be wrong.
I'd be very surprised if carriers treated that as part of your mobile-to-mobile minutes. That's the last thing they wanted to do. I'm going to get one more in here. Let me see. Got so many good ones, and I had one I wanted to put aside.
We should have the call from farthest with best accent contest.
Well, we've got two good ones from South Africa and then Australia so far, yeah. But please do, and that's one of the beauties of this is you can do it from anywhere. Well, I can't find the one I was going to play, but he mentioned that we were asking for Google Voice invites, and he said, I don't know if I should say this, but you can buy them on eBay for $2. There are people and so I tried it, and you know what? I got 7 invites. Caution.
Nice.
Yeah, but there's a caution. You can't use the same phone number twice or the same Gmail address twice. They really try to limit. It looks like they're trying to limit you to one. So you have to create a new Gmail address for every one you want to use. And you have to find friends with cell phones that will allow you to attach your Google Voice to their cell phone. I ran out of numbers. I have 7 invites, but I don't have 7 phone lines. And actually,
I thought you did, Leo.
I thought you did.
No, it's all virtual. What I figured out finally is you can assign it to one and then revoke it, and you'll still have the account, but you just won't have it attached to any phone line. So there's a little tip.
And I have one other Google Voice tip. I think last week Adam described that you can have Google Voice SMS messages forwarded to your email. Which is great. But if you also have a cell phone and you don't want your text messages forwarded to your cell phone, I think a caller that Leo played before we started taping
yes.
was asking about this.
I was
this.
Trying to find that one. Yep.
If you go into Google Voice settings under phones where your cell phone is listed, if you hit the edit button, there is a checkbox that says receive SMS on this phone. If you uncheck that box, your Google Voice SMS messages do not get forwarded to your phone, which is a really good way to save money on your text messaging if you SMS a lot.
And they'll still show up in your email.
They'll still show up in your email, yes.
Excellent. Great tip. Thank you for answering that. Yeah, I was trying to find that one. I have so many in this inbox. I have to go through them. Hey, what a great show. Thank you so much, Clint Bolton, for joining us. We really appreciate it. Clint's column is Google Watch at googlewatch.eweek.com. And we hope to have you back soon, Clint.
Great. It was great being on. Thank you, Leo.
Really, really nice to have you. Mr. Jeff Jarvis is back, baby. 5 holes or not, he's operating. Well, at least his brain is operating at 100%.
Morphine does wonderful things.
You're not on morphine, are you?
No, no.
A little Vicodin, perhaps?
I can sell some on eBay.
I found frozen peas make a wonderful ice bag. That will conform to almost.
I don't want to know how you learned that.
Almost any shape. Thank you, Jeff. It's great to have you back at buzzmachine.com. Jeff proves that there is life after People Magazine. So we're glad to have him on board. And of course, the great Gina Trapani founder of Lifehacker, still a regular columnist there. And I saw at the Harvard Business Review.
Oh, yes.
Love that. And smarterware.org is the home site. It's just a blog, but okay. Thank you for being here, Gina.
It's just a blog. Thanks for having me. And sorry about my wonky connection this week. I'll get this sussed out for next week.
She's going to plug in next time. Actually, we have microphones and all sorts of cool gear we're boxing up to send out to both of you. So go get that soon.
All right.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Again, our number, if you want to call with a suggestion, I can't get them all on the air. We get so many, but love to hear from you. And we'll put the best calls on the show is 9795 Twig VM. I'm Leo Laporte. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google.